Fisher Body Historical Team Interview. It's Wednesday, February 1st, 2006. We are in UAW Local 602's Frank Dreyer's Greenhouse. First, we'll introduce the historical team.
Jerry Smith.
Cheryl McQuaid.
John Fedewa.
Gary Judy.
And I'm Marilyn Coulter. Today, we're here with Mr. Fonnie Price. Mr. Price, could you please say and spell your name for us, please?
Fonnie Price. F-O-N-N-I-E-P-R-I-C-E.
And your address, please?
3528 Lucy Street.
Mr.
Lansing, Michigan.
Okay. Are you married?
Yes, I am.
And do you have children?
Yes, I do.
Boys, girls?
I have two boys and one girl.
Okay.
And my baby is 50 years old.
It's 50. Awesome. So, were you born in Lansing?
No, I was not. I was born in Carroll County, Tennessee.
And were you raised there?
No, I left there at an early age and went to South Bend, Indiana. There I went to school in South Bend, in Elkhart. And I came here in 1955.
In 1955?
Yeah.
So, now what's your education level?
I finished high school and had some classes in college, but I didn't graduate. And I went to Lansing Community College for a number of years.
Oh, excellent. Any military experience?
Yes, I was in the Army. I was a sergeant in the Army. And from the Korean War, 1951 to 53.
Now, what did your parents do?
My father died at an early age, and my mother was a housewife.
And what did you do before you hired in Fisher Body?
Before I came to Fisher Body, I worked at Studebaker's. And they closed. And they laid me off. And I was on my way to Flint to apply for a job. And I stopped here on Main Street to get a sandwich on my way to Flint. And there was a gentleman in there that worked at Fisher Body. And he had a $100 bill. And he said, I said, well, where'd you get that money? He said that he got that money from a Fisher Body. And you can get a job there and make all the money you want to make. I said, really? He said, yeah. So I put an application in. And he gave me his phone number that I could use as a reference. And I put my application in that day, and it took all day, so I couldn't go to Flint. I had to go back to South Bend. And by the time I got back to South Bend, they were calling me to come and work. I gave him my phone number in South Bend. He gave me his phone number here. And they called him, and he called me. So then I had to turn around and come back to down here that night to be here the next day.
Wow, that's awesome. So, do you remember the man's name?
His name was Gooseby. And I can't remember his real name, but his name was Gooseby.
Gooseby, okay.
Yeah.
So, now what year was this again?
That was in 1955.
So, you went down there. So what did you do? Did you get a room here? Did you stay with somebody? How did you do that?
I came back that next morning. I stayed in the parking lot right out here. Back in, I slept in the car until it was time to go over there and do the physical and all that stuff. So I spent the night in the car. The next morning I went over there, and by the time I finished, there was some more people around. So I asked a lot of questions to find out where I could get a room. And stuff, and there was a lady here that was doing hair. Yeah, I can't think of her name either. Anyway, I got a room from her, and I was married at the time, and I had a little baby. So I got the room. That was on Friday. I got the room, and I didn't even say it, so I went back to South Bend, and you know. Cut some ties and that type of thing to make arrangements to come back down here on Monday, which I did. And I stayed here 1 week. worked. And then I went back to next week to get my wife.
Sheriff McQuaid?
Mr. Price, you said that when you turned in your application at Fisher Body, it took all day and you didn't have time to go to Flint. Why did it take so long to put in the application?
There were so many people out here. A lot of people, and you had to be interviewed and that type of thing. And besides, it was already up into the day, that day, because I had driven from South Bend. And it was pretty close to lunchtime. That's where I stopped to get that sandwich. And it just took most of the afternoon to get an application in. And I didn't really expect them to, you know, call me that early.
Was there a long line?
Yeah, there's a lot of people. And in the, as I remember, there's a lot of people in the waiting room making out applications and that type of thing. And then we had to be interviewed. But they didn't really tell you that much. Because I really didn't have an idea that I would be hired. But that they were taking the applications and they were, they were all nice to me and everything. But they gave me no indication that I would be hired.
So, your first day, you slept in your car, you cut your ties, you come in there. What was the first apartment you hired into?
I went into the body shop, and we had the hoods with the air in your back, and we were sanding, doing the sanding to the cars with grinders and things like that, and. That dust was terrible in there, you know. But it was okay because you had this hood that covered your face and your body and your torso. And then you had the air that was coming into the back of your head so you could breathe.
Oh, so you were kind of looking like a spaceman. Huh?
Looking like a spaceman. But it was maybe, just a complete line of us, and we had our own little world in there, so to speak, because no one could come in too much because of it. And all that drying dust, you know, we could direct that fire in any direction, you know. If the foreman come in, you could just right at him, you know.
Oh, it shoots sparks at
him. Yeah, you could direct it in any direction.
So what did you think about that when you here you are, you walk in and you're in this body shop and they put you in a space suit and...
It was okay because I was young at that time, you know, and I had worked in the factory. See, I worked at Studebaker's. And I had been working in the factory for quite a while, so I was familiar with factory work, and I was hungry, you know. It didn't matter what. I had a baby. I had a wife and a baby and no money. I had been laid off for quite a while. And they paid more. They didn't pay as much as in here as they paid Studebaker's, but I was glad to get a job.
So, may I ask, do you remember what you started in at as far as wages?
It was something like 96 cents an hour. But I had, when I was working at Studebaker's, I had been making like $1.85 an hour, like that. Mm-hmm. They paid more, I guess that's why they had a business, but they paid more than any other plant around. I worked at Studebaker's before I went in service. So my seniority continued while I was in service. Mm-hmm. And they sent me my vacation pay, holiday pay from Studebaker's.
Oh.
They sent all that. Yeah, that's probably one reason they're out of business. But anyway, that was a strong union over there. Mm-hmm. And I worked there, and that was considered one of the best jobs in that state. That was because they worked Studebaker's. Hey, that's it. You know, you got to make the rest of your life.
Now, at Studebaker's, may I ask, what union was that with? Were you with over there?
That was a UAW.
Oh, it was a UAW.
Yeah.
Okay. So you found out they were hiring. You worked in the body shop, and your first day. So you guys, you said you were in your own world there. What was it like if you? How did you communicate and stuff like that if you had your hoods on and were you in spacesuits?
We had a shield, a face shield, that was made out of plastic. Uh-huh. And we could...
Oh, so you started learning to read lips.
Yeah, so to speak.
Oh! For a minute, I'm like, okay. And then I realized you had to learn how to... So you had to develop your own way of communicating
right,
in there.
Right, right.
So, When you hired in there, were there like new hire initiations, pranks or something like that? How did you pass the time? Other than shooting sparks at each other.
Shooting sparks and throwing this. Uh-huh. And things like that. Uh-huh. But we were pretty busy too. Uh-huh. You know, he had a job. But most of the time, I could do his job and mine, while he wanted to go and get a drink of water or something like that. But we had a relief man that was supposed to do that. But we could just relieve each other, because after a while, you could do the job well enough where you could do two jobs.
Now, did you work day shift, night shift?
I started working on the day shift. And after I worked until I learned the job, and then they put me on the on the night shift. But at that time, we worked 2 weeks, and then we'd be off to, 2 weeks on day, 2 weeks on night, like that.
Oh, how was that? Working every other week?
No good at all. Your body could never get adjusted to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't there very long before they changed that. And I voted against it because I would say at least I get 2 weeks on days, you know. So I voted against changing to a straight shift.
Uh-huh.
But then they passed anyway, and then I was put on days. I voted against it, still got days.
And still got 2 days. That's what I'm saying, because that's kind of difficult for a wife and a new baby and everything.
Right,
that's
right.
A lot. So now, you hired in 1955. In 1955, were there very many African Americans that worked there?
Not an awful lot. We had the menial job. We had the jobs that were kind of undesirable, you know. Mm-hmm. Moving the gates was a heavy, hard job. Trucking the bodies at the end of the line, that's a hard, hard job, you know. Pushing those bodies on the trucks from one line to another line. None of that was automatic or anything.
They had to do all that manually?
Had to manually do all that, turn the bodies around and start on the other line. And then you had the wet deck where that was hard work. And a lot of black guys worked up there.
And that was in the body shop also in the wet deck?
No, the wet deck was in the paint shop. And then they had the grinding booth where I worked.
Mm-hmm. That's where they usually put most African Americans.
Yeah.
Jerry Taylor. Jerry Smith.
How long did you work in the body shop, Dylan?
I worked in that for more than 10 years until I left the body shop and went to the millwrights.
Straight from the body shop?
Mm-hmm.
So while you, male and culture, while you were in the body shop, did you always do the grinding? Mm-hmm. You grinded for 10 years?
Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to come out, but I was so good at it that I just chose to stay in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only danger there was the getting lead poison.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no danger if you took a bath every day.
Oh.
You had to take a shower every day to wash all that. You leave all your clothing, mm-hmm. you know, at work.
Uh-huh.
You put on new ones every day.
Gary, Judy?
Yeah, I worked in the body shop in a job similar to that. At that time, did they ever send you guys down to get tested at medical to check the level?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Back then?
We had to go down every 6 weeks and get a blood test.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were doing that back then.
Yeah, they were doing that then. But I never had any problem because I never would eat in there or eat before I washed my hands. And I took a bath every day, took a shower every day. So I didn't have any problems. I didn't take the lead home with me.
Did they let women work in there at that time? Or?
No, there was hardly any women working in the plant. No, women couldn't work in there, man. There's very few women working in the plant at that time.
So, two things. And number one, I'd like to make note that Mr. Price is 78?
Six. 70, I assume he's 77.
He says, and he looks fantastic. So, obviously, he took very good care of himself in the lead booth. And because he looks perfectly, perfectly young. And but now you said there weren't very many women in there, and they were in the body shop. In the 10 years that you were down there, did any women ever start working down there?
Oh, yeah. They started to bring women in, you know, mm-hmm. in some of the easier jobs and mm-hmm. things, you know. But they wouldn't put women in the booth because the because of the pregnancy, mm-hmm. they might get pregnant and that type of thing. You know, they'd be exposed to the lead.
And now, I know you said that there weren't very many African Americans there, and then if they were there, they had undesirable jobs. So I take it there were no African American supervisors at the time, either.
No, there was. OJ was about, I think he was about the first African American supervisor. And no, he wasn't supervised then. They didn't have any then. Jack Lawrence was the first. Jack Lawrence was made there. He was about, in the body shop, he was about the first African American supervisor in the body shop. But that all came later.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So, and I'm trying to think, OJ, is that Jack O'Johnson?
OJ Henderson.
Henderson, okay. Okay. So, you said that you then became a millwright.
Yeah. See, what happened was, when I was working at Studebaker's, I applied for the millwright, and I had been accepted into the skip trades at Studebaker's when they started to cut back and lay off. But I never went into the millwrights, but they accepted me, and before I could get in, they laid me off. So I was aware of this skill trades, this better job. Mm-hmm. So when I came right into Fisher Body, and started right away trying to get into the millwrights. And I spent about 10 years trying to get into the millwrights. McKinstry was the engineer, plant engineer at the time. And I would go down and after work, I'd go and stop by his office and stop in there and talk to him. And he was quite frank. He says, he just don't have anything. Black guys, and he said, the white guys won't work with you, And I said, I never had any trouble getting along with anyone, But he said, I tell you what you do. So he said, you work during changeover and start going to community college. So
can you explain what changeover is, please?
Changeover is when the lines were down for change models from the 56 to the 57. And the skilled trades make all the changes that's necessary, so when the production comes back to work, everything will be ready to run. So the mill, the skilled trades would work during changeover. Skilled trades would work during changeover. And I would work with them during the changeover. And they would work 7 days a week, that type of thing.
And how long would those changeovers be sometimes?
3 months sometimes. Sometimes it would be 10 weeks or 8 weeks. They were led long changeovers in those days. They were always trying to get to the place where they could cut down the number of weeks that it took to finish the changeovers.
Uh-huh. Gary Judy?
Back at that time when they had those long changeovers, what did the workers do for money? Did they have subpay back in the 50s? Or?
They didn't have subpay. They had unemployment compensations.
So they just drew unemployment and that was it for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. So you're learning your craft and you started going to LCC.
I started going to LCC, taking classes. And during the changeover, I would work with different guys and I would talk to them. To the guys and find out what classes I need to take, to learn the trade. So I took mechanical engineering and drawing and welding and stuff like that.
So now, he said that he didn't think that they would work with you. As an hourly employee supplementing, doing your changeovers, working with the millwrights, how did they treat you?
I stood a little over 6 feet tall, and I weighed about 200 pounds, so that everybody treated me pretty good. I've always stood up straight, and I'd be a man everywhere I go, so I had no problem there. And I treat everybody right, and I never had any problem. I never had any problem whatsoever. Mm-hmm. A lot of people probably did, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have it. I just wouldn't. I would not allow anyone to treat me other than me. So that's what I am.
So, obviously, they did help you because they told you what types of classes you needed to take.
The different employee, different ones. I had good friends. You know, we were friends. You know, mm-hmm. when you're working 7 days with someone, mm-hmm. and it becomes a social life and a working life also. Mm-hmm. So you get to know people pretty good. And the guys were just fabulous with me. You know, they mostly apprentices because we were, you know, young and green and stuff.
So,
but we drink together, we party together, we work together.
So it extended outside of the workplace?
It extended outside of the workplace because you work 7 days a week. At that time, I was working on third shifts. So you had no social life except with the guy that you were working with.
And what were the hours for third shift?
It's from 11 to 7:30.
So that was your work family and your and became your friends?
Yes.
It did a lot of these friendships extend throughout your work history?
Even today.
Even today.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So, 10 years, you finally get into the trades.
Yes.
So, how did that go for you when you finally went in?
Well, I was the first black guy to come into the trades. So, it was pretty good. And just like I said, everybody treated me okay. But naturally, any guy, don't matter what color you are, you can give him the worst job. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I had gone to community college and I didn't publicize this, they didn't know that I had gone to school. I had learned to weld and to cut, and I had learned blueprint reading. I could draw blueprints. I had took mechanical drawing. I knew all those things that was necessary to be a millwright. I knew them in the beforehand. So when they took me in, I had to pretend that I didn't know nothing. Because they would have been jealous of me. And you come in as a trainee, I went as a trainee. You're supposed to be trained, you know. So but I knew all these things and I just pretended that I didn't. And as a result of me knowing these things and pretending that I didn't know them, I learned them so fast, they said, that's the smartest man I've ever seen. But I wasn't. You see, I had... But anyway, I hadn't been in the millwrights over a year when the superintendent came to me and told me that he wanted me to start preparing to be a supervisor. It scared the devil out of me. Because you go for 4 years training to be a millwright. Uh-huh. And I told him, I said... Don't do this to me. I said, you know, the guys would have no respect for me whatsoever. And no one, I said, I don't want to be supervisor like that, you know. Well, I said, I have a family. At that time, I had 3 kids. Mm-hmm. I said, I have a family, and I want to do better just like everybody else. But I don't want to be supervisor now. You know, I don't. He said, but you know, he said, you learn so fast in years and years, but I don't want to be. He said, wait until I have my journeyman status. And then you talk to me again. He said, the minute you become a journeyman, I'm going to make you supervisor. That's what he told me. So I had 3 years to sweat it. You know, I said, oh, my goodness. I don't, gee whiz, you know, all I want to do is, I'm happy to have a job at Fisher Body, you know. And then you turn around and make me a millwright. Oh, man, I got my twos on my side now. Shit, I'm tough. Now you're going to make me a supervisor. Oh, I'm scared to death. You know what I mean?
So now you had a family and you came in. And you were making like 96 cents an hour.
Oh, yes, yeah, right.
Working on the line in the body shop. Mm-hmm. How much of an increase did you get when you went to, as far as hour, pay per hour, as being a millwright?
By the time I was in skilled trades now, the pay rate has changed considerably because we got a raise every year. Mm-hmm. You know? There were no merit raises. The only raise you got was to the union. Mm-hmm. But there was almost like a dollar an hour difference, mm-hmm. between the skilled trades, mm-hmm. and the hourly. But I don't remember what it was, you know,
but
at that
good.
Time. I really don't.
But it was, you just remember it's good. So
right.
Now, during that 3 years while you were preparing for what was coming, and you knew that was coming, what were some of the things that you had to put in line to prepare you to be a supervisor over your coworkers?
Nothing, because I didn't do anything different. Because I had a bed that I would go and sleep in every night and all that stuff. So I didn't do anything different. I just kept learning and everything. And along about the last year, they started to put me on different jobs so that I could get diversified. And I didn't really like that. But I had most of the time that I went through my training, I had a crib. I was in the paint department.
Uh-huh.
And I had my own area of responsibility. And I just knew the paint department. But as far as building things, you know, and things like that, I would do on some weekends or doing changeover or something like that. So I had to learn all those things. And I started to diversify, but that wasn't even my doing. I was kind of set up by the way things were.
So, a couple things. Number one, I want to jump back to one thing. You said you guys made beds and slept. What types of places did you sleep in? Were there not rodents and things like that inside the place?
Not as much as you would think, you know, but on top of the ovens, it's always warm up there. And in the summertime, the heater houses, they all go cool, you know, the air is cool going through there. So you just pick the place and you have your bed. You didn't have to work until the line went down. So you would just rest until the line went down mostly. And then you...
Cheryl McQuaid. Mr. Price, could you please tell me a little bit more about your booth experience? You were in there for 10 years. Could you tell me a little bit more about the atmosphere, some of the things that you did just to get the day, go through the day? I mean, you couldn't talk to anybody. You were reading lips. Could you just tell me a little bit about the booth?
Well, okay. We had taken the job. It was an undesirable job to most people. But we had worked in that so long that we really enjoyed it, you know, because it was our own little world. And we played games and bring a book in and you'd sit there and read the book. And there's very few jobs at that time where you could read, you know. But people didn't, the supervisors didn't bother you much because you were doing a job, and you were doing an undesirable job. And we would throw discs at each other because we had the head protection. And we wouldn't hurt each other or anything. We'd throw snuff cupboards, throw discs, and we just played most of the day. It was just playing. You do your job, and then you'd read or play. There were some people in there that was, hey, you know not to fool with him. Okay, so there's always people like that, but there were always people that wanted to play all day. As a matter of fact, the guy that played more than anyone was the guy that Dick, the guy that got to be the president of this union.
Dick.
Is it Bennett?
No, I'm trying to think of his last name.
Sandborn?
Sandborn. He and I used to play all day. And, he was one guy. But anyway, I couldn't believe that he was president of the union. But anyway, we played a lot, and we protected each other, and the supervisor wouldn't fool with you because if they had a problem, they would take you outside and talk to you. And if the guy ahead of you or behind you knew what the problem was, he would have to go and straighten it out so we could keep them from coming in there and bothering us. And so we just kind of helped each other, and we got the job done.
Jerry Smith here. Could you explain to us exactly what the discs are you were talking about you were throwing?
Well, those are round disc objects that you put on a machine to grind the different parts of the body. That's what makes this work. You grind, you grind the discs against the body and you make it smooth.
Were they paper, metal?
They were made out of cardboard type thing.
So they weren't heavy or?
Oh no, they were just.
Was it sandpaper like?
Sandpaper like. It was just sandpaper on a flat piece of cardboard to make it sturdier. They just called it this, I guess.
Cheryl McQuaid, you had mentioned that you would shoot sparks, and depending on how you angled the machine, you could shoot sparks and aim them at somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Were those sparks ever shot toward a supervisor?
Oh, yeah.
And was there any kind of disciplinary measure because of that?
No. That's why most of the time they would pull you outside to show you what your problem was, and they could talk to you too better and take you outside. But they weren't maliciously done. That was just a part of the game, you know. Shoot sparks at the supervisor. That was just part of making the day. And he wouldn't get angry or anything because he really expected it. Might even grab a machine and shoot him back at you.
So if you shot sparks at someone, it wasn't something that hurt them?
Oh, no. No.
Just scared them, maybe?
No, not really, because they probably worked in there themselves, and they know, you know, they're familiar with sparks. And it's just, it looks worse than what it is. It's just shooting sparks at someone.
Mr. Price, I wanted to ask you, you said that you didn't eat inside that booth because of the health reasons. So what did you do for lunch, and where did you eat your lunch?
We go to the cafeteria for lunch. Well, anytime you're working in the booth and you come outside, you have gloves on in the booth. When you come outside, you leave your hood and your gloves, and there's the wash basins on both sides of the booth. So you come out and you wash your hands, mm-hmm. and you wash your face, and then you go and you eat. Or if you come out for a coffee break, you come out and you wash your hands before you have coffee.
So you said you went into the cafeteria. Was the cafeteria close to the body shop?
It was centrally located where all the departments could go to the cafeteria. The paint could go, the trim, body shop.
So how much time did you get for lunch?
You get 30 minutes for lunch.
So there was enough time to wash up, take all your equipment off, wash your hands, go up to the cafeteria, sit and eat, and then walk back to your job. And
right. There was no, you know, there was no deviation from it. You know, the line started, you had to be there. So you were there at the line stopped, or you were there when the line started. And it was enough time.
So now you said also that you read in the book.
Right.
So is that when you took time to do your studies for you never read your textbooks at work?
No.
It was too dirty in there. It was too dirty, okay.
And it was I would only have one class, you know. I didn't need to work. As a matter of fact, I didn't want anyone to know that I was going to school in the first place and the second place. I could do my own schoolwork at home.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Cheryl McQuaid, why didn't you want anybody to know you were going to school again? I'm sorry.
It's all kinds of people, you know. I didn't want anyone to think that I was trying to be better than them or anything. So I would do what I would do, and I would keep it to myself.
Mm-hmm. 1955, 1965. Mm-hmm. What was the climate like for you in the community? What did people think about factory workers? How did it affect the community back then?
Oh, we were the community. And it was always considered a good job if you worked at Fisher Body. Mm-hmm. You know, because it was one of the desirable things, working at Fisher Body, our Oldsmobile. And you were accepted in the community. And we were all, just to give you an example, you know, back in those days, Most of black people lived on pretty close together on the west side. And like when it snowed, we didn't have snow blowers and that type of thing. But I remember back in 1958 or 59, something like that, we had a big snow, and the whole community just get out there in the middle of the street and shoveling snow in the street so we could have, so the fire truck could get through. I mean, it was just a community thing, you know. And if somebody cooked barbecue over there, then but it cooked a lot of it because, you know, people are going to drop, come over. And I joined church, Friendship Baptist Church, in 1955. And they just took me in as a, you know, just like I'd been a member for years. They took my whole family in, you know, and it was just a community thing. And it, but I don't want that anything to do with working Fisherbody.
And even, but now, in a sense, though, even though it wasn't necessarily Fisherbody, Friendship was close to Oldsmobile, yes? And how did that work, being in a church that worked so close to a factory?
Well, that was our church, you know, factory, both Fisherbody and Oldsmobile. It was just a black church. And it worked fine.
And at that time, it was one of the larger black churches in Lansing.
It was one of the larger and more prominent churches.
So now we're going to go back, fast forward to when you become a millwright.
Okay.
So you're doing that, you have your 3 years, you're getting ready to go in to do that. So you get your journeyman's card.
I get my journeyman status.
And then what happened?
Right away they started bugging me about being a supervisor. And they had moved me, they would move me around to learn different phases of the job, because I had been so concentrated on in one area. They were reluctant to take me out of that area because I kept it running pretty good. But anyway, so they started to move me around. And it wasn't everybody that, you know, wanted me to be a supervisor. But I finally did come in as a supervisor. And they put me over into the shipping department, shipping bodies to Oldsmobile, across the street over here. And they hadn't built that part over there at that time. And they didn't train me. You know, supervisors mostly come in and you work with another supervisor for 2 or 3 weeks. Until you get the lay of the land. But they just put me over there. I don't know if they were trying to see if I could do it or trying to make me fail. Or I don't know what the reason was. At the time, I didn't resent it. I mean, I didn't think too much about it. At the time. They just called me in and I went into the office and they said, you got shipping today. So I just went on to work. And okay. And then I guess I don't know what happened, but anyway, I just went in and I told the guys that I was new and I didn't know what I was doing. I need your help. So I guess that's what happened.
Okay. Now I wanted to go, and I know that skilled trades is its own world, in a sense, different from production. But how did those other production workers feel knowing that here you were, an African-American man, getting ready to go into the trades and then getting ready to become a supervisor? How did they take it? Did you ever receive
anything? Yeah, a lot of guys said that, you know, that I wouldn't be able to make it, you know, because the guy, the white guy, not going to do it. You know, they're not going to let him be a supervisor. And some of them was really behind me and, you know, stick with it, buddy. You can do it. And some of them were, you know, jealous, and you know, you just.
So you got both.
You got both ends of it. But I just never said. I just, you know, it was just never a problem with me. I said, hey, I got a job over here, granted. I know I can do it. I can do it better than anybody else in the world. If I can make it here, I can make it over there.
Okay.
So, but I said I can do this. So, I just. I always asked for help. I always did. And I always got it. The guys just, when you come in, I don't know. It's something about people that instead of, you know, being the boss, you know, we're all working together here. And that was my attitude. And it just worked.
Okay.
Yeah, I asked for help over there, and I got it. But I would do, if we're, this is our department, this is our department. If what you need, you let me know. And I'll get it for you, you know. And I did. If, you know, I would be on their side all the time. If a guy, if one of the workers, father in Tennessee, sick, and so you go and you take care of your father. When you finish, you call me and, you know, you come on back to work. But I would help them and they would help me.
Oh. And was that just Bonnie Price's way of doing things? Or was it something that, as an employee, you knew what you would like to have seen in a supervisor? Maybe you did or didn't see it, so when you had the opportunity...
I didn't analyze it. I guess I didn't analyze it that way. It was just, hey, we're all working here together. As long as you're working with me, I work with you. And that was just my attitude about everything. If you need, you get one pair of gloves a week. If you wore your gloves out or you lost your gloves, you get another pair of gloves without even saying, without even asking. You know, who cares about whether you use one pair of gloves or two? But that back in those days, you know, that was a big thing. You couldn't get one pair of coveralls on one pair.
So how long? So you stayed a supervisor until you?
I stayed a supervisor for like a year and a half, and then, you know, they cut back, and I had to go back to Ollie, and then I would have to go be a supervisor in another department type thing.
How did that transition work for you?
I went in with the same attitude everywhere I went.
So it wasn't a difficult transition for you?
It could have been, I guess, but I wouldn't let it be because I just wouldn't allow it to be, you know.
And because you were a good supervisor, when you came back, people didn't mind you coming back.
Well, I had a reputation, I guess, as being kind of easy. Mm-hmm. But I would get the job done. And a lot of guys wanted to work with me. They asked to work with me. They wanted to work with me. And I always did say, with me. And they didn't work for me. They always worked with me.
Did you have the same social rapport with your fellow supervisors as you did with your fellow during the special?
Yeah, I got along with the supervisors and things good, but I played golf.
Ah.
And I drank with them. We party and we play golf. And I bowl with them. Stuff, you know.
So you did a lot of the activities.
I did a lot of the activities
outside. And you had, did you have supervisory friendships that extended outside the plant until this day also?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then you went back and forth from being a journeyman millwright to a supervisor, and did at any point you became permanent as a supervisor?
Oh yeah, I became a permanent supervisor, and then I stayed over for years. And then they decided that they wanted to make me a general supervisor. Then I go through that period again. Oh my goodness! But I said I can do anything. My supervisor called Mike, the superintendent, plant engineer. Called me in and he said, I knew that they would move me around, you know, from different places. And he called me and said, we want to make you a general supervisor. I said, what do you think about that? I said, can you do it? I said, I can do anything. I said, I can do your job, you know. I said, I can do anything, you know. The thing that made all the difference, I think, to me, what made the difference in that plant for me, and I did it kind of unknowingly, was when I went to school and I got ahead of them, you know, and I came in and got the reputation of being smart, you know, because I had gone to school and I knew some things that I had to know when I went into trade, so I kind of got reputation of being smart, which I was not. I just learned some things early.
Carrie Judy?
I have a question. You mentioned that, you know, when you started out, you wanted to get ahead, mm-hmm. and moving from production to a journeyman to a supervisor, and then to a general foreman. Did you see, did you get the pay increases that you expected? Was it more or less than you expected, or was you happy with the increases that you saw?
I was happy with the increases that I saw because I didn't really know what to expect. I had a lot of good friends that was hourly still, and I knew what they were making because I would take the checks to them every day if I pay them all the time. And my pay was much better than theirs. And when I got to be a general supervisor, they gave me a big raise, you know, and then I got merit raises every year. So it was all money was always good. And they gave me a key to the executive cafeteria, and I'd go to lunch up there today, you know, and they have a big Lazy Susan there with full of nuts and mints and stuff.
That was a special dining area for you had to be a general supervisor or up to eat there?
That's right. And
can you tell us a little bit about that, what the difference between the two cafeterias were?
Okay.
Well, actually, there was a difference between three cafeterias, was
it not? It was just two cafeterias.
Oh, so the regular hourly supervisors ate with the hourly personnel?
Right. And you had to have a key to get it to executive cafeteria. And you go in and you sit down and at a chosen place wherever, and you'd have people to wait on you and bring what you wanted. And if you wanted it made special, you'd have them make it special. But I was the only black in there. I was the first black boy in there, you know. And boy, I'm telling you, that was hard, you know. But I said, by cracking, I'm the general foreman, I'm going in there, and I'm going to make it. And when I first went, I would go in, and I tell you, the worst part of the day was having to go to that cafeteria at lunchtime, you know. But I said, hey, because I had a lot of friends on supervisors, you know, and we go out together and all that kind of stuff. And I said, I'm going to make it. I'm going to do it until I'm comfortable with it, you know. And when I first went in, I would go in and, you know, people are habits, you know. Where you go, you sit every day, you sit that place every day, beating on the table. And I went in and I didn't know where anyone else was sitting or whatever. I just wouldn't find me a seat. that's where I sit. And it was, they were giving me a little room and stuff, you know, at first. And then pretty soon, everybody else started to kind of migrate to where I was, you know. And then it got to be a place where lunchtime was the best part of the day because we would have a ball in there, you know. And I was right there with them, and they were all enjoying and everything. And they would, a lot of the guys that wouldn't work with me outside was working with me on the inside of the cafeteria, not working with me, socializing with me on the inside.
So was it still the same half-hour lunch, or did that change from?
Most of the guys had an area of responsibility, and they had to be there at a certain time, but we were not as, you know, if you stayed over 10 minutes or so, 15 minutes, you could do that. You know, that was just, so they were a little more lax than that. We didn't, you know, you set your own schedule. Most of the guys were making out their own work schedule.
So did you also get preferred parking also?
Yes, we had preferred parking. We had a supervisor, general supervisor parking area, general supervisor. It was on one side of the street, and the hourly and the supervisor were on the other side. And and you didn't have your name on your parking space, but it's just like when you're seated in the cafeteria, you have habits and you always do the same thing, so you always park the same spot. And so, and that was, that's priceless parking space that I parked over here, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like that.
Gary, Judy, now you were in there when they changed that parking where the supervisors and superintendents had their own special parking lot, and it was changed to where everybody had to park in the same lot. Was you still there then when
no,
that happened?
I left that in 1984, and they changed that in 1984.
Yeah, I was the person that got that changed.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, they never changed it while I was there. And they still had the executive cafeteria when I was there. They changed it right after that. Right after I left, they changed that. And they changed it where all, you know, everybody was eating the same place.
Yeah, that was Frank Shatters to me. If you remember Frank, he was the plant manager back then. Was he there when you was there?
No, he wasn't there. He came after me.
But they started the EPG programs, did they have that when you were there?
No, they didn't have that either. Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. But, I left. But at the time, just before I left, I was a young man. I was 55 years old when I retired. And I had been in a glass office for years and years and years. I mean, I had my office had glass on three sides. And I had been just observed, you know. It appeared to me that I had just been observed, you know.
You were in a fishbowl.
Yeah, I was in a fishbowl, you know, and I just got tired of it. I got tired of it. They started grooming me to be a superintendent. I didn't know what they were talking about. That was when they were talking about joining Fisher by an Oldsmobile together. And he started grooming me to be a superintendent. And I asked him, my boss, I asked him, you know, if I was doing a good job for him. And he said that I was doing an excellent job. So I said, why are you going to boot me if I'm doing such a good job for you? And he said that he needed a superintendent and I was going to be it. And I said, I don't want to be a superintendent. You know? What he was going to do, I was been in skilled trades all the time. I had industrial truck painters, the welders, small tool repair, mechanics, and shipping. That was all my responsibility. And sanitation on both ships. That was my responsibility. And I had learned to do that job, and I had learned to do it well. I could do my job and go play golf in the afternoon. So I knew I was doing a good job, but he was going to make me a superintendent. And he was going to make me superintendent over sanitation in both Oldsmobile and Fisherby. And even though he was promoting me, I felt like it was a demotion. I would have been superintendent with my own car and all that stuff. Office on that side and office on this side. But I was in skilled trade. I was skilled trade. I didn't want to be sanitation superintendent. And I didn't want to be in the fishbowl anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, if you go to that, I'll retire. Mm-hmm. So I retired.
Is there anything that's been an awesome story and an awesome journey? And is there anything that we haven't asked you that you'd like to go on the record? People knowing about your life as in Fisher Body?
I don't know. I hadn't even thought about a lot of those things. in a long time. And, I don't know. Just for the record, I'll say that I really enjoyed working there with Joe Horns. I really did. They really provided me and my family with a better than average life. Mm-hmm. We were middle class or whatever, you know. But my kids had a lot of things that a lot of other kids didn't have. Mm-hmm. As a result of me working at Joe Horns. And they always treated me fairly, you know. They always treated me. There were some occasions when things happened, but that's just life. But it was always pretty good place to work. And I always looked at General Motors as a family. You know, and they were a part of my family, and I liked it, and I thought they were on my side. And they would tell me that they coerced me and to go from Ireland to Sarah, that you'll live better, and you'll work better, and when you retire, you'll have a better retirement. And they lied to me about that. And I'm resentful of that. Mm-hmm. I really resent that. When I worked, I had a key to the executive dining room. I had a place to park. I made good money. I got bonuses, raises. All those things were forthcoming to me. Mm-hmm. And they indicated that they would continue to be that way mm-hmm. when I retired. But the moment I retired, they walked me to the door. They gave me my clock and put that foot in my behind. Mm. As a salary employee, because you're talking about hourly here. But listen, I'm telling you, the way they treat the salary employees, they retire is ridiculous. Really? It really is. Since I retired, I tried to get a bunch of the retirees to go together. Mm-hmm. We have breakfast together out here once a month and talk about this, and that's all we did was talk about it. But they don't. Since 1995, I have not had a raise of any kind mm-hmm. from General Motors. Mm-hmm. Now you think about that. And that's over 10 years, and I haven't even had a cost of living increase in my pay. But they have taken $159 a month away from me mm-hmm. to pay my insurance. I retired in 84, and I had two raises since then. Now, that's 22 years without a raise. That's living on what you were making 22 years ago. How would you like to do that? You know, just think about that. Living on what you made 22 years ago. I'm not saying that I'm in poverty. But I am saying that they don't treat the salary employees well. Because of the hourly employees and the union, they get a bonus every year. I don't get any bonuses or raises.
Do you think that's why some line supervisors come back to the line before they retire?
No, because they don't believe that General Motors will treat them that way. I talked to salary employees now that are my friends, mm-hmm. I tell them don't retire as a trainer, but they can't go back to hourly now. But when they could, I said don't retire as a salary employee mm-hmm. because.
Gary, Judy, so do you see a need for more unions in this country after being treated the way you were treated?
Well, of course, the salary should organize. Salary should organize, and they should have a union. And they shouldn't allow. We don't have no voice. Three or four years ago, at the auto show, I don't know if you guys have heard about it or not, but at the auto show, we got the buses together to take salary employees down to the auto show, and we called the newspapers, and we were picketing down there at the auto show, and. They said, you can't pick it down here. But we did anyway. But it was cold. But we got an article in the Free Press and our pictures and things. But it didn't amount to a hill of beans because General Motors knows that they have the upper hand. We don't have a voice, and there's nothing we can do about it. And they just raised my insurance again this year without a raise in my income since 1995. They raised the...
So, and even though you felt that after you retired, you were done wrong,
mm-hmm.
and the door was shut on you, Lansing Fisher Body has always been considered the capital of quality. People wanted bodies made by Fisher. What would you attribute that to? What made our workforce different?
Oh, being a supervisor, that's what I have to say. It was the supervisors. It was the quality of people. The quality of people here in this city. They're so work-orientated, you know? And the most of the people I came in contact with were just normal people, but they did some excellent work. And that's just the way it is here in this city. You know, people just work-orientated and do quality work.
Fisher Body has been a part of this city of Lansing for many, many, many years. Now the doors have closed, and soon the building will be coming down. Being a resident of Lansing and a retiree from there, how does that make you feel? What do you think about that?
Oh, man, you just feel like there's something missing, you know. I just drove by the plant over there, and it just gives you an empty feeling, you know, just to see that, you know. You don't want to see it. They're going to tear it down. And you just hate to see it. You really, really do. You know, you feel like something's missing. But as far as Fisher Body itself, I just think it's been a wonderful journey, you know. I enjoyed working with Fisher Body. And it will always be, you know, I get a warm feeling thinking about it. Even though I can't say the same thing for General Motors, you know, as a whole. But Fisher Body was a good place to work.
Mr. Price, I want to say thank you for sharing your memories with us. And, you know, it was awesome. And all I can say is, and thank you for paving the ground for people to come behind you.
Thank you, Mr. Price.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Right. I really enjoyed your interview.
Thank you.
I really, really do. I really, that is just...